You know, if you look at the beginning of this week's portion, it starts off, Yishlach Yaakov Malachim. Yaakov sent messengers. He sends them, Lefanov El Esav Achiv, he sends messengers to his brother Esav. So, if you start right over here in a vacuum, Yaakov sends messengers to his brother. We don't know who these messengers are. We don't know the nature of these messengers. If, however, you start this week's portion in a different place, if you start at the end of last week's portion, then it may give a little bit of insight. Because a couple of verses beforehand, it tells us, V'Yaakov halach l'derko. And Yaakov, he went on his way. V'yifku'u bo malchei Elokim. And then he bumps into angels of God. Now, first of all, this is interesting because in the beginning of last week's portion, it uses a very similar terminology. V'yifka b'makom, that Yaakov is struck along the way. There he leaves his parents' home. He leaves the land of Israel. And he bumps into angels. There his bumping into angels takes place during a dream where he sees the ladder and the angels going up and coming down. Over here at the end of last week's portion, when Yaakov returns to the land of Israel, it's almost like two bookends, namely these angels coming and going, which surround the entire story of Yaakov being out of the country. When we then pay attention that these angels are there, Vayoma Yaakov kasher ra'o machane elokim zeh. Sorry, Vayoma Yaakov kasher ra'am, and Yaakov said when he saw them, Machane Elokim zeh. He said, this is a camp of God. And Yaakov called this place, well, Machanayim is what he says in Hebrew. In English, one would translate Machanayim as two camps. He sees it as the place of two camps. And of course, the question is, what are the two camps over here that he sees? But first, before I get to that, let's note over here, these are angels that we're talking about. Yaakov is incredibly spiritually sensitive. Rashi gives us insight and tells us that there are different angels in the land of Israel and in the diaspora outside the land of Israel. And at this point, we have, in a sense, a changing of the guard. The angels that had accompanied him on his sojourn outside of the land are now going to take leave, and now new angels. So they're according to Rashi, when it talks about two different camps, what are those two different camps? One is a camp of the angels from the land of Israel, and the other is a camp of the angels from outside the land of Israel. And that's the two camps that Yaakov sees in front. The text itself doesn't say that. The text itself says that there are these angels, and Yaakov calls this place Machanayim. The second camp could actually be the camp of Yaakov. But there's some interesting issues here. First of all, the plurality or the duality of camps, to break off into two camps, is a bit of foreshadowing of what's going to take place when we read the first couple of verses in this week's portion. Secondly, the issue of there being angels over here is also some foreshadowing to a couple of different issues that will spell themselves out. But let's start this week. And Yaakov sends messengers or angels to Esav. Rashi tells us these are real angels. Where did real angels come from? Well, you don't have to look so far. Look just at the end of last week's portion. There are angels about. And Yaakov sends one to Esav. And by the way, one has to wonder, if Yaakov has an ability of sending real angels, that's an incredible thing. Why would he then subsequently be scared? Why would he be afraid? If you had some angels who have your back, even better, if you have some angels who you can send as your personal emissary, then why all the angst? Why all the fear? He says, he sends these angels, Yitzavol some, and he commands them, Lamor, saying, Ko temru l'aduni l'esav, thus you shall say to my master Esav, Ko amar v'adecha Yaakov, thus says your servant Yaakov. And he goes on to say, I lived with Lavan, and I've been away for a while. I've collected certain things. And the angels come back, and they give the following message. And maybe this will tell you why he's afraid. It says, the angels return and they say, Vayeshuva malachim Yaakov lemor, Banu lechicha l'Esav, we came to your brother to Esav, V'gam alech l'kroscha, not only that, he's coming, he's on his way to greet you. Ve'arbameos ish imo, and he has together 400 men with him. Now, let's be honest. If all that Esav wanted to do was to say hello and how you doing and, you know, look into renewing old brotherly ties, arguably, you do not have to bring 400 people with you in order to accompany you on that mission. It sounds very much like a military expedition. And what Esav is actually doing is he's coming out in order to declare war. The response of Yaakov to this is, Vayiro Yaakov Ma'od, and Yaakov is very frightened, Vayetzer lo, and it caused him a great amount of pain. Vayachatz es ha'om asher ito. And now he divides up the people that are with him. He divides up the people and the flocks, the cattle, into two different machanos, into two different camps. So now we realize that the camps that we saw at the end of last week and the camps that we have over here, it's very easy to say they're not connected, except it's not very convincing. Once you see the two camps here, you realize there's some kind of connection taking place. But if there is a connection between his division into camps and these angels that he has with him, again, why would there be fear? Even accepting that his brother's coming to prepare for war. And he says, and if Esav comes to attack, and one camp is defeated, at least the other one will be able to escape. And then Yaakov says the following. He says to the God of Abraham, to the God of Isaac, God, you told me to return to my land, to my birthplace, and things will be good. Katonti mikol hachasadim. Katonti is from the word katan, small. I don't deserve all of the chasadim. What does chasadim mean? It would be like the word chesed. All the kindness. Katonti mikol hachasadim. I'm undeserving of all of the kindness. By the way, the Gemara says that a person should never be full of themselves, that having pride is a bad thing. So the Gemara says, how much pride are you allowed to have? So it says an eighth of an eighth, which is a very funny number. So an eighth of an eighth, theoretically, would be a 64, 1/64th. So depending on what you really deserve, the amount of pride you should have is 1/64th of what you really deserve. So the Vilna Gaon said, no, that's not really what it means. It is an eighth of an eighth. He goes, look in the eighth portion of the Torah, Vayishlach. What's the eighth verse in this week's portion? This verse. He goes, that's how much pride a person should have. Katonti mikol hachasadim. I'm really undeserving of any of God's kindness. But then he says, I'm undeserving God's kindness. Umikol ha'emes asher asisa es avadecha. And all of the truth. Now this is a very funny use of the word truth. Because it's one thing to say that you're undeserving of God's kindness. It's quite another thing to say that you're undeserving of God's truth. Of course, it's quite appropriate. There's a book called the Sfas Emes. And he points out, he goes, what is Emes doing over here? What is this? Why truth? Again, you don't deserve God to be kind to you is one thing. You don't deserve God's truth. We all deserve God's truth. Look, the truth is quite the opposite, that we're generally afraid of God's truth. God's truth is what scares us. And Yaakov says it's undeserving of God's kindness and God's truth. He then says, and I've crossed the Jordan. When I crossed, I only had the staff in my hand. And now I've become two camps. So again, he comes back to these two camps that are here. And he prays to God, save me from the hand of my brother, save me from Esav. For he's afraid that mother and child will be killed. That night, Yaakov sends gifts. I'm going to skip a little bit. During the night, he takes the women, takes the children, he divides them, he spreads them, and apparently he's looking for a formation that will, on a pragmatic level, be able to create the most amount of safety. As he divides everyone up, Yaakov finds himself all alone, and he's attacked. And I want to skip the attack for a moment and see what happens afterwards. When he gets up in the morning, he lifts up his eyes and he sees that Esav is there with the 400 men. And then again we're told that he divides the children, Vayachatz es ha'yeladim alev al rachav al shtei ashvachos. He divides Leah and her children, Rachel and her children, and the other women and their children. And he puts the servants first with their children, and then he puts Leah with her children, and in the very back he puts Rachel and Yosef, which now apparently, instead of having two camps, now we have three divisions. But instead of being divided this way, they're lined up. Again, presumably, if you attack the front, then the back will be able to escape. And he places Yosef. And he places Yosef and his beloved Rachel as far in back as he can. I want to raise a question. What are the implications of this division? And what I mean by that is, I can look at this in two different ways. One way of my looking at it could be in terms of right then the pragmatic military strategy. And the second way I can look at it is in terms of what type of echo or what kind of impact it makes for the future. Which means, what kind of lesson is here for the children, or for that matter, for the Jewish people in the future? For that matter, how does Yaakov's approach to this entire issue create some kind of a power which future generations will need to contend with? Having asked that, I want to return now to this part that I skipped. We're told Yaakov is all alone. And when he's all alone, he's attacked. It could be that if you're cynical enough, you're not bothered by the attack. Doesn't tell us who attacks him, why he attacks him, what's the background for it, what he wants. So as I said, if you're cynical, you can say so. A Jew gets attacked. What's so surprising? I need an explanation why somebody attacks a Jew on the street. He attacks him because he's Jewish. If that answer satisfies you, that shows that you're very, very cynical, disturbed. You may be a realist, but you're disturbed nonetheless. If you like that approach, then I can tell you something else on this week's portion. We see that when Shimon and Levi, before they kill this whole city of Shechem, they make them all circumcise themselves, and then they kill them. He says, already going to kill them, just kill them. Why circumcise themselves? So you can say the real answer is because after they circumcise, they will not be fit for battle. So but I once heard somebody say, no, that's not the reason. The reason is first they circumcise, then once they circumcise, and now they're all Jewish. So if somebody kills a bunch of Jews, who's going to care? So that's why. So as I said, if you like that, again, you're quite disturbed. And it could be. It could be you have reason to be. But let me go back to my question. Why is Yaakov attacked? It says, Yaakov is all alone. Vayivaser Yaakov levado. Yaakov remains by himself. Vayavik ishimo lo sashachar. A man wrestles with him. This is in chapter 32, verse 25. And a man wrestles with him till the break of day. Vayarik hi lo yachalo. He sees that he can't defeat him. Vayigabakaf yericho. And he hurts him in the hollow of his thigh. Yaakov's thigh is hurt as he wrestles with him. He says, release me, for the dawn will soon break. And he says, I won't release you unless you bless me. He says, what's your name? He says, Yaakov. He goes, no, your name will no longer be Yaakov. Your name will be Israel. For you have struggled with God and struggled with man, and you've prevailed. Whole thing.
Who says this?
Excuse me?
Who says this?
This anonymous assailant. By the way, it sounds like this anonymous assailant has a great deal of knowledge. No, your name isn't Yaakov, your name is something else. So the whole thing is quite strange. And even to say, ask him, who are you? Excuse me, you don't know the guy's name? You've been beating him up. Don't you know at least the guy? Why did you attack him? Who are you to rename him? The whole thing is, as I said, quite strange. According to tradition, who is this? According to tradition, correct, this is an angel of Esav. But according to tradition, what I can insist, it's an angel. Now, before you get yourselves excited one way or the other, the fact that it may indeed be an angel should not be all that disturbing. We've had lots of angels around here. As I said, angels last week, the beginning of this week, there are angels about. Angels are hanging about. What should be so disturbing is another angel. Incidentally, arguably, the oldest commentary to this text. What would you consider to be an old commentary? If I can find you a commentary which is thousands of years old, When I say thousands of years old, I'm talking over 2,500 years old. How can I find a commentary that old? Because later on in the book of Prophets, later on in the book of Hosea, there is a comment about this verse. Is that interesting? Was it worth coming to class just today to hear that? You didn't have to. You could have looked in Rashi. But the problem is Rashi says it in passing, and Rashi makes a terrible assumption, and that is that his readers know Tanakh. And when his readers don't know, then I guess the explanations that he gives sort of just pass them by. In the 12th chapter of the book of Hosea, we have in the 4th verse the following statement. Babeten akav es achiv. He took his brother by the heel in the womb. Uva ono sara es Elohim. And when he was stronger, when he was older, he struggled with, and the word used over here is Elohim. Elohim could mean God, or it could mean something which is very powerful. The next verse says, "Vayosar el malach, vayuchal." He struggled with the angel, but he prevailed. "Bocha," he cried, "v'yischanan," and he begged, "beis el yimotzenu, v'shami deberimo." He wept and he prayed for him, and he found him in the place called Beit El, and that's where he spoke. Now, I'm quite confident you have no idea about what I just read. Correct? But there's a couple of elements you need to pay attention to. First of all, the verse says something which is wonderful in terms of foreshadowing. It directly contrasts the struggle that Yaakov has in the womb with Esav with the struggle that Yaakov has with his assailant. Which means, Yaakov, before he's born, we're told his mother experiences pain, and the two of them are struggling about. In one verse it says, you struggled with your brother in the womb. And again, the term used there is Yaakov, because as they come out, he's holding the ankle, he's holding the akev. And then it says, and you struggled when you were older, then you struggled with Elohim, which, as I said, in some cases means God, in other places in Torah it doesn't mean God. By the way, in my opinion, it would be worse to pronounce it Elohim if it wasn't God than to pronounce Elohim if it were God. Right? You appreciate that? Because then you're calling something which isn't God, God, is worse than calling God, God. Okay? So don't get confused on that. Yes? Very similar. It's similar. It's similar, but it's not the same. Leave that for now. Leave it. Maybe next week. It's a good idea. Maybe I'll talk about that next week. I depressed people too much in my class this morning, so I need something cheerful to speak about next week. But what's interesting over here is, it says you struggled with your brother in the womb, then you struggled with this higher force, and the very next verse says, you struggled with the angel and you were victorious. So, as I said, Hosea calls the assailant an angel. So who am I to argue with Hosea? Who am I to argue with the interpretation? But I still don't know why they struggled. I still don't know why they were fighting. And it's in the attempt to unravel what's going on, which is we're gonna find something which may be quite disturbing, and then I'll depress you as well. The rabbis identify Yaakov's being attacked because he was guilty. Hey, by the way, it's very easy to read the Torah all the time. Jews are right, non-Jews are wrong. Jews are good, non-Jews are bad. Yaakov is good, Esav is bad. Esav is bad, Esav's angel is bad. Everyone's bad, we're good, end of story, right? That's it. as I said, it's very easy to read things that way. The rabbis in the Medrash begin to spell out a different picture over here, or to paint a different picture over here. We should mix our metaphors. And the picture that they paint for us is not necessarily as pretty as we would like it to be. We'll start with Yaakov being afraid. Yaakov is afraid and he says, God, I'm undeserving of your kindness. Why is he undeserving of his kindness? And he says, because Esav is more deserving of God's kindness than he is. Why should Esav be more deserving? Because Esav has been around taking care of his father all these years. Well, Yaakov was not involved in the performance of that mitzvah. And as Yaakov sits and tries to analyze, you know, he's about to go to war. And when you go to war with someone, what do you want to know? You want to know if you in heaven have more merit than the other side does. And you would like to believe you do. I mean, I hope during the war this summer that at least some of us had the passing thought, at least we noticed, that our adversaries, both in the north and in the south, were religious Muslims. They were not non-religious. It's not the PLO. PLO is not a religious group per se. But now it was. Both Hamas and Hezbollah are religious. Not only are they religious, but their point of power within the community is because they do an incredible amount of social services. They do an incredible amount of kindness. They do an incredible amount of chesed. So when your adversary is an adversary, again, the PLO ripped off the Palestinians. The Palestinian condition is because of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. The leaders got rich and the poor people remained poor, and it was their interest to keep the poor people poor. Hezbollah and Hamas are not the same as the PLO. And again, for you, your worldview is very simple. Jews are good and Arabs are bad. End of discussion. So then, far be it for me to point out that you may not be the most sophisticated thinker. But if you pay attention and you realize that your adversary is somebody who is praying five times a day and somebody who believes in one God and somebody who their women are walking around in an incredibly modest dress, and we can keep on going down the line. Again, I am not going to tell you that they are the most moral society. I'm not going to say that there's no issues involved. But what I'm saying is that you cannot ever, ever underestimate your enemy when it comes to their military might. Certainly don't underestimate them in terms of their spiritual merits as well. And what the rabbis are trying to tell us in the Medrash is that when Yaakov is comparing himself with Esav, he starts to get scared. And the reason he gets scared is because he knows that his brother's been doing some things, at least, which are good and deserves credit for that. And he says to God, I may not be deserving of your kindness. I may not be deserving of your truth. That's a very frightening thought. Now, as Yaakov crosses over and he meets this angel of Esav, and that's what the rabbis tell us, this angel is the angel of Esav who attacks him. Why does he attack him? So one of the things that they tell us is that they attack him. First thing, there's a teaching from Rabbi Lezer Mivermaiza, 800 years ago, he wrote this. He says, the angel meets Yaakov and says, Yaakov, you're a liar. He goes, what do you mean I'm a liar? He goes, remember when you went into your father and he said, who are you? You said, I'm Esav. You lied to him. You are full of deceit. By the way, whose side would you rather defend in that argument? Would you rather defend Yaakov in that, or rather defend Esav in that? Which is the easier defense? Admit it. That we have a harder time defending it. There's another teaching, which is very much spelled out by the Targum Yonasan, who says to Yaakov, Yaakov, you didn't keep your word. What did Yaakov say? Remember when he left Israel, he said, God, give me clothing, give me food, take care of me, I'll give you a tenth. So he says, where's the tenth? What happened? And by the way, when it says, where's the tenth, this is the problem of making a vow. Sometimes you make a vow, you have something in mind, but it's not necessarily what you said. What did he say? I will give a tenth of everything God gives me. So he says, okay, you have 12 kids, give one over. Oh, hold on, I didn't mean the kids, I meant the money. You didn't say that. So I'll give a tenth of everything God gave me. He says, give one over. And this Targum Yonasan is fascinating because it tells us then that he does the math and he says, okay, I can't give you any of my four firstborn, his four firstborn from four different wives, because the firstborn already belongs to God. But I have to give you one out of ten. So it says that he counts, he has eight other children, includes Dina. He has eight other children at this point. So he starts from Shimon and starts counting. Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, and counts all the way through. And what do you get to? You get to eight. But he has to give one out of ten. He has 12. He can't give those four. So what does he do? Goes to the top of the batting order again. And he goes back to Shimon. Shimon gets to number nine. Levi gets to number 10. And he says, okay, number 10 Levi belongs to God. According to this, this is the source that Levi is going to belong to God, and the Kohanim and the Leviim will come. As I said, and this source is long before they weren't slaves in Egypt, and long before we're told that they didn't sin with the golden calf. It goes all the way back to this point, because Yaakov said, I'm going to give one out of ten to God. But again, that itself is interesting to me, the whole development in terms of the tribe of Levi and in terms of the Kohanim and Leviim. But what's equally interesting to me is that we then have a conflict, and the conflict is between the power of Esav in the world and between Yaakov, and the power of Esav is again saying to Yaakov, you're not keeping your word. You have not kept your word. You said you're going to do something. Why are you full of deceit? The Medrash tells us that when Yaakov meets up with Esav, again, what did the Torah say happened to Yaakov? It says that his thigh was hurt. So the Medrash says that God said to him, it's not going to be so easy for you to defeat Esav. You know why? Because Esav has the merit of himself. He took care of his parents. He has the merit of his father. He has the merit of his mother. He has the merit of his grandfather. He has the merit of his grandmother. He's got five things going for him. Now stop a second. Which five things? Esav is a grandson of Avram and Sarah. Esav is a son of Rivka and Yitzchak. Esav himself has merit. Yaakov, you're in trouble. See, we don't like to look at it that way. How do we like to look at it? Yaakov's a grandson, but guess what? He's not the only one. And the Medrash is saying, Yaakov, you better watch out. And this claim, it says, is not as weak of a claim as you would think it is. In fact, quite the opposite. Then the same thing goes on in the next line to say, he hurt his thigh. Now, what does the thigh symbolize? What is the thigh trying to express? And the Medrash here tells us the thigh is an expression of children, of future the loins, of future generations. And says, just as Yaakov's thigh was hurt, it means that future generations, and I'll read the words, Noga he hurt, b'tzadikim uv'tzidkanios, righteous people, righteous men, righteous women, b'nevi'im uv'nevios, prophets and prophetesses, shehein asidim lamod mimenu, who will one day come out of him, v'ezu, and who are these? They're Dorish al-Shmad. This is the generation of persecution. And unfortunately, there's two ways of understanding this. One way is that these righteous people will stand up against the persecution and die and be killed and be hurt by the persecution. And the other way of understanding it is that they may end up giving up to the persecution, and even righteous people could end up converting because of the pressure of persecution. And we don't like to understand it that way. We would prefer to understand that a Jew would never be able to give in to another religion. But again, I want to ask you the question. What if the other religion was not as weak as you think they are? What if the other religion had some merit as well? What if the other religion was not completely wrong? And I'm being very careful now. I'm not saying it's right. What did I say? It's not completely wrong. What if they do have some merit on their side? And if you're a truth seeker, how could a truth seeker possibly end up on the other side? Do you understand my question? How can a truth seeker possibly end up on the other side? And I'll give you the answer. If they find that our side is full of lies and deceit.
Well, the higher truth will always win in a conflict between two truths, that's Hegel.
That may be Hegel, but there's also, Hegel is looking in terms of pure intellect. And I'm adding a concept of emotion as well. And when it comes to the real world, there is not just pure intellect, there's also emotion. And if people are told, this is truth and we have truth and we are right, and then they see among our people lies and deceit, lack of honesty, lack of the best word in the English language, lack of menschlichkeit, right? Lack of being a mensch. Then they'll say, you know what? Although not lots of other good, decent people, we don't have a monopoly on this. You know how many Jewish kids get messed up, especially girls, by the way, get messed up when they're brought up in religious homes, go to religious schools, and they're told the only decent people are Jews, and non-Jews are not decent, and they're not good, and they're not moral, and not ethical, and they're terrible people. And then they go to college, and they meet all these nice, intelligent, decent non-Jews, and they realize that somebody's been telling them something which isn't true. And especially if the same people happen to know yeshiva students who are not necessarily nice and decent. And I hate to say it, not every yeshiva student is decent. And I don't hate to say it, and not every non-Jewish secular university student is necessarily bad. There are a lot of good, decent people out there. But when you throw in the emotional issue, I've been lied to, when you throw the emotional disappointment, they have a higher truth and this is how they behave, at that point, even good, righteous, decent people can end up being hurt in the future and moving over to the other side. Not because the other side is righter than this side, it's because you're upset with this side. Right? You agree?
Yes, sir.
Even Hegel would agree, or not necessarily?
What's rational is real.
And that's what's scary. Incidentally, you want your homework for the week? Go back and read the whole book of Hosea. Okay, if you don't want to read the whole book, at least read the 12th chapter and try to figure out why in the world is he introducing at this particular juncture the whole story of Yaakov's struggling in utero and then struggling outside. What does that have to do with the larger story? So I'll read to you a couple of verses before and a couple of verses after. Ephraim surrounded me with lies and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah still rules with God and is faithful with the holy ones. Ephraim guards the wind and follows after the east winds. He dearly increases lies and desolation, and they make a covenant with the Assyrians and the oils carried to Egypt. The Lord also has controversy with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his doings will he reward him. He took his brother by the heel of the womb, and by his strength he strove with God. He strove with an angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication to him and found him Beth El. And there he spoke with us. And the Lord is the God of hosts, and the Lord is his name. Therefore turn to you, God, keep loving kindness and judgment, and wait for your God continually. As for the traitor and the scales of deceit are in his hand, he loves to oppress. And Ephraim says, I've become rich, I found wealth for myself. In all my labors there shall find no iniquity in me. That was sin. And so on and so forth. Do you realize what it's surrounded with? It's surrounded with verses beforehand that tells us about lies and deceit. It's surrounded afterwards, it comes with these verses that describe how the traitors, how their scales are corrupt. You know what a corrupt scale is? You have different scales for buying and for selling. When you buy your merchandise, the scale is in your favor. When you sell your merchandise, the scale is again in your favor. But you use two, it's, by the way, it's even better than having two different books. Having two different scales is a wonderful way to make money. That's what he's accusing them for. And right in the middle, it throws this striving of Yaakov and Esav. Does this give us a little bit more insight? It means that the Esav of the world, or the guardian angel of Esav, can turn to Yaakov and say, for how long are you going to be full of deceit? But there's a resolution. Did you notice the resolution? The resolution is, stop being Yaakov. Become something else. Stop being Yaakov and be Israel. And it could be, again, I don't want to be overly naive, it could be there are times that we need to be Yaakov. It could be there are times we need to be cunning. It could be there are times we need to know how to protect ourselves. And maybe when we deal with the Esavs of the world, maybe we deal with the Lovins of the world, we need to know how we could be cunning and how we don't get taken advantage of. But again, I want to ask the same question I asked before. What's the price that you pay for it? What message did the children get? What message do subsequent generations get? That the ends justify the means? That to be Yaakov is something which is worthwhile to be? Or do we need to be Israel? Now, part of what's interesting about all this is that according to the prophets, and again, this is a problem, we don't know the prophets well enough. According to the prophets, the goal is not to be Israel. There's actually three stages. There are three camps. You start off as Yaakov, and then you move from Yaakov to Yisrael. And Yaakov is somebody who uses deceit, and it's on this world, and Yisrael already begins to strive with divinely things and strives on another level. But eventually the name gets turned into something else. Eventually Yaakov becomes Yisrael, and eventually Yisrael becomes the name of Yeshurun.
Okay.
Yeshurun. Yeshurun. Which has as its first three letters Yashar. Yashar, which means straight. In a number of different verses in Deuteronomy and Devarim, we find the name Yeshurun being used. Sometimes, by the way, pejoratively and sometimes positively. But I just want to use as the turning point here the writings of Renachem Mendel Mishklov, one of the students of the Vilna Gaon, commenting on the verse in Bamidbar, Ki lo nachash bi Yaakov v'lo kasam bi Yisrael. The Jews are not involved in all kinds of divinity. What's the word? Divinations. Trying to figure out the future by using all kinds of crystal balls and the like. Jews are not involved in that. It writes why. He explains why. Ki Yaakov ishtam. Yaakov is simple. Yaakov is complete. Yaakov doesn't have to search. By the way, tam is the opposite of mace. Tam is the opposite of death. So Yaakov is tam. He doesn't have to search off looking into the world of death and so on, using seances and so forth. But then it continues and says, V'Yisrael yashar. Yisrael is straight. The name that I told you before, Yeshurun, the Ramban tells us the name Yeshurun is the opposite of Akov, of Yaakov. Yaakov means twisted. Yeshurun means straight, honest. V'yihi b'shurun melech, and there was a king in Yeshurun. Targum Onkelos translates V'hava b'Yisrael malka, that Yeshurun is a translation of Yisrael. We have, in Devarim, we have Yeshurun being made fun of. Ve'yishman Yeshurun b'yivat. Yeshurun became lazy, complacent. But again, Yeshurun is another name of Israel. And according to the commentaries, Yeshurun is the ultimate name, because Yeshurun is when we, in a sense, reject any of the deceit that was used. Having said that, if we go back and perhaps look at the very first verses of the book of Hosea, it says the word of God was to Hosea when? During the time of Uzziah and Yotam and Ahaz and Chizkiah, the kings of Yehuda, and the days of Yerovam, the king of Israel. Which means there's two different kingdoms, there's division. And I asked you before, what's the price of dividing up the people? And the answer may be that the price is a people divided. That once you divide up the people, then there becomes this lack of unity. And I'm more important than you, and you no longer have a nation. In case you're not convinced that that's the subtext here, in the beginning of the second chapter, it says, of Hosea, it says, the people of Israel became as numerous as the sand of the sea. V'ayam mispar b'nei Yisrael k'chol hayam, asher lo yamad v'lo yisoper, which just can't possibly be counted. Okay, I'm skipping to the next verse. And may these two different kingdoms of Judah and Israel come together, Yachdav together, Rosh Echad, and let the day come when they have one leader between the two of them. Which means Hosea is saying, when does Hosea prophesize? During the two kingdoms. And what's he saying? May the day come that we have unity, which means instead of having a people divided, instead of two different camps, instead of using deceit, which may be necessary militarily, I want to stress that. It may be necessary militarily, but again, I ask the question, but what's the price that takes place? What's the price that's paid for dividing up the people? And over here, we may very well see that the price is division. Later on, in numerous places in subsequent chapters, it speaks about a lack of truth. Shemu dvar Hashem b'nei Yisrael, ki riv la Hashem im yoshvei aretz, ki ein emes ve'ein chesed. God says, I'm upset with you. Why? Because you have no truth and no kindness. So now we realize the problem. If the Jewish people don't possess truth, we have a very serious issue. We don't possess truth because you have trickle-down morality, which is worse than trickle-down economics, which doesn't work. You have trickle-down morality where the lower people look up at the higher people or look up at subsequent generations and say, well, he was able to do this, and therefore I'm going to conduct myself the same. And what you end up having is a society which is not based upon truth. And that's what Hosea says. And when Hosea has to come, and again, the next chapter, chapter 7, I'll skip a little bit, he says, Kipa alu shakar v'ganav yavo, because you're full of lies, and so on. The main idea over here is one of lack of truth, full of lies, and then he gets to his prototype of the problem, and that's Yaakov. But Yaakov can't remain Yaakov. Yaakov needs to become Yisrael. But Yisrael isn't enough, because Yaakov needs to become Yeshurun. It needs to become straight. You want a beautiful verse that talks about the future redemption. In the 40th chapter of Yeshayahu, the chapter begins, Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami. May my people be comforted. Dabru Alev Yerushalayim, speak to the heart of Jerusalem. Call to them. Next verse, verse 3, Kol Korei Bamidbar, a voice comes out of the desert, Panu Derech Hashem, open up a path towards God, Yashru ba'arava miselah lokenu, and make a straight path to God. And then it goes on to say, I'm skipping a little bit, v'haya ha'akov lemishor, and may that which is twisted, but the name is Akov, connected to Yaakov, may that which is twisted become straight, lemishor. And if that happens, what does the next verse say? V'niglok vod Hashem, and then the glory of God comes out, u'kol basar yachtav kipi Hashem diber. That once Yaakov represents straightness, then all the nations of the world will recognize and see the glory of God. Which means when Jews don't behave in the way that they need to behave, when Jews don't behave in the manner that they're supposed to, we give non-Jews an excuse to attack us. And over here I want to stress, you can be able to justify every single thing that you do in terms of God. But if other people are able to use you as their excuse, then it's still not good enough. And over here, if subsequent generations are able to look at Am Yisrael and say that there's something about Jews which are not completely honest, and let's face it, we as a people do not necessarily have the greatest reputation in terms of business ethics. We don't necessarily have the best reputation in terms of paying taxes. We don't necessarily have the best of reputation, and the list can go on and on. There's a serious problem with that. That's where the problem is. But I want to finish with a thought which is found in the Shemi Shmuel, where he rereads some of what we've already seen today. He says, Yaakov sends malachim, Yaakov sends angels. What's an angel? So we're told in the chapters of the fathers, every time you do a mitzvah, you create an angel. So what does Yaakov do? He sends all of his angels over to Esav, and he shows him all of his mitzvahs, shows all his good deeds, and shows how deserving he is. This could impact on Esav, which means the way to reach out to Esav is to show the good. When Esav sees that what's twisted, when Esav sees what's not straight, when Esav sees Yaakov in terms of the word Akev, that's where things are very concerning. But if Yaakov is able to send the good and able to send the good deeds, then we have an ability, and he says it clearly, of finding great spirituality within Esav. He says, you know, the fact that non-Jews ever converted, he says, is based on Yaakov sending the messengers to Esav. Because Yaakov sending the good deeds and sending the messengers woke something up within Esav, and those are later the souls that came back. Which means that we have an unbelievable responsibility. Receiving the Torah, being children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov is responsibility. If you don't follow the direct responsibility, it's not that things are just not good. You create then a negative. And for people to see a Jew, or as certain parts of the world, to say he Jewed me out of something, becomes a way of saying that becomes synonymous with dishonest business practices, nothing more needs to be said.
Jew is a verb, is in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Well, Shakespeare certainly helped. that you don't have to say anything more. We then understand the problem. But we also understand the solution. The solution is that which is twisted needs to become straight. And what we need to do is to identify the Yeshurun within us and how fascinating it is that that's the force of Esav in the world. The angel of Esav is the one who grabs Yaakov and says, Yaakov, you Jew, be Yisrael. Don't be Yaakov, be Yisrael. And he's the one who identifies it and he's the one who names him. But that's also what hurts us in terms of the children and subsequent generations. If Jews and other generations will see more honesty on the other side, they will not stick around. If they see more decency in other places, they will not stick around. Future generations are going to be hurt by this, because if Esav is coming after taking care of his parents for all those years, now you understand why Yaakov is afraid. Now you understand why Yaakov says to God, I'm undeserving of your kindness and I'm undeserving of your truth. Why would Yaakov be undeserving of truth? What does truth have to do with anything? And you realize that truth is everything. Because Yaakov may have had to do certain things. To do business with Lavan is not a simple thing. And he may have had to use certain practices when you do business with Lavan. But you're going to come back into Israel. You need to throw all those away. And you need to be Israel. And to be Israel isn't enough. You need to be Yeshurun. I mean, face it, we have a country of Jews. You realize how bad this country is? And I don't like to say bad things about Jews. But it was easy when we lived in Europe, we had all the non-Jews to rip off. But now you only have Jews. So if Jews are ripping off Jews, so what are you left with? You're left with an immoral society. You're left with a corrupt country. Which means what we need to do is to find the inner Yisrael within us. And if that's not clear enough, we need to find the Yeshurun within us. We need to find this way to be good, to be straight, to be honest, to be decent. And if we're able to do that, what did the Navi say? What did it say in Yeshayahu? Then all the nations of the world will take note, and the glory of God will then be revealed, and that's what's going to usher in the Messianic age. Have a good Shabbos.